It's A Couple Cooks, the podcast with Sonia and Alex Overheiser. We're a couple on a mission to find the tastiest, good-for-you eats you can make in your kitchen. Because the way we eat can make a meaningful difference.
Join us as we chase after real good food through stories, recipes, and conversations about cooking at home and eating well. Welcome to the A Couple Cooks podcast. I am Alex.
And I'm Sonia.
And we're glad you're here.
We are the husband and wife duo behind the website A Couple Cooks. Alex is the photographer and I'm the writer. And together we develop recipes here in our Indianapolis kitchen to inspire your cooking journeys.
Today on the show, we have a woman who takes her artistic expression, her business savvy, and helps develop new businesses and great community in the South Bronx. So stay tuned for that. But first, we have a few FAQs from our cookbook that's launching in February, and we wanted to address a few of those questions here on the podcast.
That's right. We have a cookbook coming out February 6th called Pretty Simple Cooking, and we are so excited to get copies in your hands. We wanted to talk a little bit about some of the questions we've been getting.
So first, how did you come up with that title, Pretty Simple Cooking?
Well, good question. The premise behind the book is it's our story from not cooking at all, eating fast and frozen food, to getting married and learning how to cook together every day. And what we've found over the past 10 years is that cooking on the regular and eating healthier food, it's not easy. But when you change the way that you look at food and your lifestyle, it can actually be pretty simple. And so the book shares our 10 life lessons of how we've transformed our lives to revolve around cooking every day, and it's become a pretty simple way for us to live.
All right, we're going to skip ahead a few questions to those lessons themselves. Is this like a new diet?
It's not a diet. It's kind of like the anti-diet. And a lot of these lessons are just life lessons. So, for example, one of them is failure. So learning how to handle failure and learning by trial and error. That was a big piece of learning to cook for the two of us. And for me, that was a little bit harder than for Alex, but learning how to just jump in, be fearless, and try some new recipes without worrying about being perfect is one of those life lessons that we've taken away from the kitchen that helps us to be able to cook every day.
So we have 10 of those lessons interspersed throughout the cookbook, and each one is paired with a beautiful watercolor that we had illustrated to match the lesson.
Wait, I thought that you were asking the questions.
Well, I'm allowed like to answer some too, I feel like. I've just got them reading them over here. All right, so it says there's 100 vegetarian recipes in this cookbook. Is this cookbook just for vegetarians?
It is not. And one tagline that we had been using when we were developing the book was a vegetarian cookbook for non-vegetarians. So we actually are not vegetarian. We call it flexitarian. You've probably heard us talking about this on the podcast if you're a longtime listener. We eat a lot of vegetables, though, and a lot of the meals that we eat are vegetarian. And the biggest question we get from our readers over on the blog is, how can I eat more vegetables? How can I incorporate them more into my lifestyle in a creative and delicious way? And so that's another reason that we wrote the book, is to show how delicious eating vegetables can be and try to convince people that it's easy to start getting more vegetables in your diet, and it can even be fun and delicious. So we wanted any eater, no matter what your diet is, to be able to make recipes from our book.
All right, here's a tough one. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
You provide free recipes every week on your website. Why would I buy a cookbook?
That's a tricky one. Well, the reason that we wrote the book was that we wanted to have our favorite recipes all in one place. And another fun thing about the cookbook is that these are all new recipes. So there are a few favorite recipes in there, but most of them, I would say 90% of the recipes, are all new work. So these are new recipes that we've created just for you to be pretty simple to fit into your lifestyle. And for me, I mean, Alex, you and I cook a lot based on online recipes, but there's something special about having this collection of recipes that all goes together. It's all bound on paper, and it's a physical representation of a philosophy on cooking.
Now, am I allowed to answer these questions too?
Sure. Did you want to add something?
Well, I just wanted to add that I feel like a really common question we get is, I'm just starting to try to eat healthy. I'm trying to eat clean. I don't know where to start. And when we look at our website, there's just hundreds of recipes, but it's not really like every day you should be cooking these things. And I feel like we put in a lot of just everyday great meals, breakfast, lunch, dessert, snacks, everything that you can just start out cooking and open up the book and go.
Right. That's a really good point. And one thing I want to highlight, I'm not sure if we've mentioned this on the podcast before, but one pet peeve I have when I open a cookbook is that I'm just not sure what recipes are quickest and easiest. And the way we wanted to structure our cookbook was that when you open a chapter of the book, you'll know that the quickest and simplest and easiest recipes are at the beginning of the chapter. And then as you page through it, they gradually get a little more complex. So that's another feature that we wanted to add that I think is a step above an online website of trying to find recipes.
All right, let's wrap this up. How do I buy the cookbook if I want one?
Well, you can go over to Amazon or other online retailers like Barnes & Noble. We have a little link on our website to all of them. If you just go to couplecooks.com and click cookbook, you will see all the information there. And if you're looking to buy the cookbook for a holiday gift, you can still do that, even though they will come out February 6th. We have created a cover download, so you can download the cover. It has a little red bow on it. Wrap that up and give it to your gift recipient. Let them know that they'll get a book on February 6th.
Perfect for those last minute shoppers. All you have to do is download and print.
Exactly.
And we have one more exciting way to buy that book. If you love to support local bookshops, you can actually buy the book there. Our publisher just told us to give them the name of any bookshops where you would be buying the book, and they will make sure it's in stock on February 6th so that you can go in and buy that book. So if that's the case, you just email Sonia@acouplecooks.com, and she will make sure that book is in your local bookstore.
Make sure to spell it with a J.
Sonja@acouplecooks.com.
All right, let's get to this interview. Majora Carter is a leading urban revitalization strategy consultant and real estate developer. She's also a Peabody Award-winning broadcaster. She has won so many different awards. I can't even mention all of them, but she's been on BusinessInsider.com, SiliconValley 100. She's been one of Goldman Sachs' 100 Most Intriguing Entrepreneurs. And her 2006 TED Talk was one of the first six to launch that groundbreaking site. She has an incredible amount of accolades, and she's also a MacArthur Genius Fellow. I sat down with her to talk about some of her latest projects in food, and she was an incredible and inspiring person to be around. Here she is. Majora Carter, welcome to the A Couple Cooks podcast.
Thank you.
So I wanted to unpack a term that is very dear to your heart, food desert. Can you explain a little bit what a food desert is, and maybe is that even the correct term?
Well, the term food desert, which I think is used quite generally to describe lack of access or places where there's a lack of access to healthy and affordable produce in mostly low status communities around the country. And I think it's sort of used in a way that's actually very incorrect, because food desert implies that there's nothing there. But the way we like to describe those areas is more along the lines of demand deserts when it comes down to food, because demand, you know, people will determine, you know, it's not up to a grocer or to a sneaker store or to anybody else to determine what is demand. It's their response is to meet that demand. And so it's not like there's no access to food and healthy, affordable stuff here. It's basically that people haven't been demanding it. And because the second that they do, believe me, grocers and everybody else will come up with a way to make it happen. What's really interesting is that over the course of the years when that term has been used, I think that there have been folks, you know, who have been in the food equity or food sovereignty or food justice movement, whatever you want to call it, you know, have actually done a pretty decent job, you know, of making it so that around education, at least, that people understand that this is something that needs to happen, that we do need opportunities to have healthy and affordable produce in the South Bronx, which is where I'm born, raised, and still live, definitely, you know, in that realm. But now we're actually seeing huge quantities of opportunity for people to be able to shop for healthy foods, healthy fruits and vegetables, all within walking distance, which has been wonderful. And, you know, there's a $12 food box that regularly provides about $40 worth of excellent produce that's available once a week. There's a grocery store that does go out of its way to make sure that there is, you know, healthy options available. And they're here, but do they do as well as the fast food stores or the dollar chicken stores or places like that? No, they don't. But again, I still think the fact that they're there means that movement has happened. So again, it's not so much a food desert as it is a demand desert. And we do have some work to do, but I think things have actually changed a lot.
That's a really great way to reframe it. And so maybe the question isn't how do we get these healthy groceries and restaurants there, but how do we get the demand for that there?
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And I think that's where there's an enormous amount of work that already has been done. More we can do, obviously. But I know that as far as our work as a urban revitalization strategist and real estate developers has actually benefited, frankly, because the idea that healthy options are something that need to happen in communities, low status communities such as the South Bronx, absolutely. Because when and it's consistent with the kind of data that we collected, you know, through surveys and focus groups about what are the kinds of lifestyle infrastructure pieces that people want to see in their community, the kind that would keep them from moving out. And if they had an opportunity to do so, and things like cafes restaurants and also even exercise studios were the kind of things that people wanted to see more of, which are typically not the things that you even think about when it comes down to a low status community that's often a very low income community of color, such as the South Bronx. But because of that data that we took in, we decided that we could take a leap and be the people who are actually starting, you know, the first cafe that this community has had since the 1980s, early 1980s, mind you, you know, where it is, you know, specifically a place where people can come in and get super high quality coffee, specialty coffees or espressos and lattes with all different kinds of dairy and non-dairy products. We have, you know, whole grain, pastries. We offer a full serving of vegetables in each one of the communities that we serve. And, you know, we're doing okay. So this, and we've only been around for about a year and a half at this point. We have also, we're co-developers on what we're hoping to be a restaurant incubator, which is basically just a sort of a fancy word for a food court with local chefs who are doing a range of different types of food offerings. And we want to be really aware and cognizant of the idea that it needs to be curated so that there are healthy options out there. Because right now, the Bronx produces lots of culinary talent, but it doesn't stay in the Bronx. And this is one way that we're hoping to provide a low-risk way for future restaurateurs to sort of get their feet wet in the restaurant industry and provide a place for them to just do their cooking and do that well. And then another operator will actually manage the dining area and the bar. So this is, we're really excited about that kind of stuff. And also we're incubating another entrepreneur who's been actually doing pop-up fitness classes around the city and mostly in the Bronx and in Harlem. And she's really just wanted her first brick and mortar spot so she can just, you know, hunker down and just do all of her boutique studio classes there. So we're really very excited about these opportunities. But again, you know, we owe a lot to the fact that there have been a lot of grassroots efforts to increase the idea of a healthy lifestyle, that it is not just possible, but really important for people to have in communities like this.
So let's go back to the Boogie Down Grind Cafe, the cafe that you mentioned. I love this idea of just creating a sense of community around a community gathering space and then allowing this space to have nutritious and wholesome options. You mentioned a lot of different coffees and serving vegetables. How did this idea start?
The idea, interestingly enough, the idea to do a cafe didn't start just because we were very into coffee, which we are, but it what a cafe actually represented was this idea and actually a very physical place in which people could build community. Mm-hmm. Because when, from our perspective, community is not just a place, it's an activity. And what do you need in order to do an activity? You need a place to do it. So, and in particular, a place that's not your home or your work. But if you think about the way that that most cities and towns are planned, they were actually the center of almost all of them was the town square. You know, that's where the church was. That's where, you know, the market happened to be. That's where the seat of government was. And all of those things happen in those areas. So, and we've kind of lost those kind that sense of third space where people gather, especially in low status communities like ours. So we had to recreate them in order for people to feel as though like there is an opportunity for us to get together and, you know, be amongst each other, you know, whether it's to just, you know, to talk about, you know, politics, the weather, pick up a date, you know, a job, whatever. I mean, those are, you need places to do that. You can't really do them at your inside the, you know, the four walls of your home or at your place of business. But creating more of those spaces actually creates a sense of community and safety and well-being and pride when there are these beautiful spaces that help you feel as though your community is something that is lovely, that extends beyond your house.
That's so powerful. And when I think about the neighborhood that I live in here in Indianapolis, it's changed a lot since I've lived here. And what draws me, like endears me to my community are those places, those gathering places,
yes.
The coffee shop mm-hmm. or the restaurants that I can walk to or the grocery that I can walk to.
Yes, absolutely. And that's not uncommon. I mean, if you look at many of the best places to live, you know, around the country, it is that walkability. You know, it's kind of why you've got, senior citizens and millennials are sort of competing for the same space within the compact urban cities because they want that space together.
That.
And so we've got to, it's true, right? It's kind of funny when you think about it, but I love that idea because then it gets, you know, you get the whole intergenerational thing and it can be beautiful, but we just have to build appropriately. And, that's what's exciting, you know, to us as developers, because those reurbanization, those are the trends that we're seeing. And, you know, you can, the devil's in the details, obviously, but design is where you can fix all that stuff. And good design will help you do that. And food, and because that is something that everybody uses in some way, shape, or form, of course you can build those type of community building activities around food. And that's why we started focusing on the cafe, and then the restaurant incubator. And soon there'll be other places like that.
How has the community responded to the cafe? You alluded that it's pretty positive, but can you give some examples?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I find both wonderful and sad at the same time is that when many people come in, we went out of our way to create a very beautiful space. It's got, you know, exposed brick walls. It's got reclaimed wood all over the place. Mm-hmm. You know, it's sort of a mini gallery. There's plenty of local artists in this community, whether they're making beautiful jewelry or paintings or photographs. You know, we sort of set that the space up to accommodate that, and people actually sell their art from there as well. We have a real focus on service, on customer service. So you are greeted with a smile and a warm hello the second that door opens. And so folks will come in and it's kind of like, what did I, this doesn't even feel like it's in the Bronx. And so on some level, I'm like, I understand that because we're not known for those kind of beautiful spaces in our community. We're just not. So I'm like, oh, good. Glad you noticed. But on the other hand, I'm like, dag, what, the expectations of our communities are so low that it makes me really sad. But, you know, but it's true. It's like, I've also done, in my past life, I've also worked on park development as well and actually created and spearheaded the very first waterfront park we've had in this community in more than 60 years. And And it was really interesting. But again, it was the same type of thing. People were like, this place is beautiful. It's almost like it doesn't belong here. Mm-hmm. And I was like, no, that's not true. But again, those are the kind of lowered expectations we have of ourselves and our own communities and what's around us. That's what we're challenging, you know, the notions of, because I don't believe anybody rises to low expectations. And we create these very physical projects as a way to help people see the beauty in themselves as well.
So looking forward, we have the South Bronx Restaurant Incubator. You mentioned a little bit about that before. Where are we in the process of that becoming a reality?
Yeah, so we acquired the building a few years ago. We now have a financing partner as well. So the money's there to start building. And now we just have to find an operator. And so we've been looking around for a lot. And it's super exciting because there have been some nibbles, which has been great, and some interest in terms of what can happen there. So we're very excited about that.
In what way will design play a piece into community and experiencing food in the incubator?
Oh my gosh. It plays an enormous role. We have a lot of, there's a sort of whole food court movement that's happening around the country, you know, has given us just such tremendously beautiful examples of the way, you know, whether it's Our House in Baltimore or Bergen up here in Brooklyn and New York City, there have just been these really beautiful ways where, you know, it is designed around this center hub where, you know, there's the dining area, but also the cozy seating area, you know, and then a bar, and then you have the kitchens, because the whole idea is that when you walk into this space, like you are essentially greeted by other people, you know, enjoying the same space. And so again, design is a really important piece of it, but there's, I think, some principles around it that are, you know, going to be pretty easy to implement. But essentially it's like you're walking into like the Cheers bar. That's the way I want to feel, is like, you know, people, whether they know your name or not, you feel welcomed, and you can fix that in terms of design.
Let's talk a little about your story, about how you got here. The two programs that we mentioned are just a little drop in the bucket of all the things that you've done. So I would love to hear a little bit about your story, where you grew up. We know that it was the South Bronx, but a little more about how you got to be doing what you do today.
Sure. Yeah, so I was born in the late 1960s, you know, in the South Bronx. And it was around the time when there was so much financial disinvestment in the country. And the South Bronx, you know, for younger viewers out there, we really did become this national symbol of urban blight. I mean, there were we were infamous for landlords torching the buildings that were here. Because there was no kind of way to finance, new business or even old business. And they found that torching their buildings and then collecting insurance money was probably the only way.
Wow. So they just burn them down instead of deal with the problem.
Absolutely. Yeah. And many of them, you know, for housing, apartment buildings, sometimes landlords would literally just like give the pink slip over. You know, to the people that were living there, and say, look, this is not my problem. And it happened a lot. But my family had been here since the 1940s. And my father moved up here, you know, he was a Pullman porter, and he bought his house here, you know, like part of that great American dream. And then, you know, less than 20 years later, it kind of started to unravel. But we had a house, you know, it was paid for, so that's why we stayed. We couldn't afford to leave it. But again, I grew up, you know, listening and seeing, you know, my neighborhood on the nightly news as this awful place that, you know, one should leave as soon as possible if you had any opportunity to do so. And so I took that with me, you know, definitely embraced that ethos. And it was just like, I'm going to use education to get out. And I did. And, you know, then like many of the bright, hardworking, you know, smart kids in communities like this, you know, we were told in certain and uncertain terms that you will grow up and be somebody, but you can only do so if you get out of here. You need to measure success by how far you get away from this community. And, you know, we took it to heart, and I did. And I went to Bronx High School of Science, which is a really competitive, specialized high school here in New York, and got myself into Wesleyan University and had no intention of coming back to the Bronx until I had to, which is when I got into graduate school and needed a cheap place to stay. And that was my parents' house. And it was just a horrible defeat. But it was, great. I'm 27 years old and I'm living in my parents' house again. This is great. And they were, my father was fine with me, with his baby girl staying there. My mother was like, oh, I just got rid of all of you. It was really funny. But then it was really great. Actually, my parents were very elderly at the time. So I got to know them as an adult, which was awesome.
What was your graduate degree in?
My graduate degree was in English with a concentration in creative writing.
Oh, okay.
Which is, kind of funny. And my undergrad was in cinema studies, which is in film production, which is both really hilarious. I learned to be incredibly creative because I apply all of that to my work right now. Because you kind of have to see things not as they are, but as they could be. And that is what an artist does, and that's what I am at heart. So when I moved back home and found out about the city's plan to build more waste facilities on our waterfront, there was a conflict that I was going through internally. I could either just be like, I don't see this, or I'm not going to care because I'm just biding my time so I can get a great film job and get out of here. Or I can, feel what I'm feeling, which is that this is just wrong. And actually being a part of the solution, to support my community, mm-hmm. communities like it. Because it was clear it was what was happening was because we happen to be a poor community of color and thus politically vulnerable. And our city and state were like, they're not going to notice another heat waste facility on the water. And that's when I started picking it into gear. And again, using my, artist sensibilities to think about projects that would impact positively our community, its self-esteem, and the environmental quality that was here. So I worked on things like park park development because there were no parks on our waterfront at that time. And again, spearheaded the first waterfront park we've had in this community in decades. We worked on greenway projects, worked on actually a highway decommissioning project, which is just starting to come to the fore right now, which is really exciting. And also green jobs training and placement systems, which really gave people in our community probably their first taste of understanding that they could have both a personal and a financial stake in the improvement of the environment in their own backyards. And that was a really wonderful space to be in. But it became clear also that I needed, that as our communities started to change environmentally, that economically and socially, we were still so far behind, and our status, as a community, as a very low status community, showed through. And I really started then. I realized I had to start focusing on the economic situation within our communities as well. And then when I moved into the private practice with my own with urban revitalization strategies and real estate development, that's when I realized, this is about real estate development. And that really does determine how communities are planned and promoted, as either healthy places or not, by saying that, poverty is not a cultural attribute, and it's all about how you design a community in order to make it so that people see themselves as, really positive agents of change in their own lives mm-hmm. and in their own communities.
Wow, that's powerful. You started this as an artist, and I think your career trajectory makes more sense to me now, just knowing that you start as an artist and you're pursuing beauty, right? You're seeing things how they are, and you can see where beauty can be. And I think that's kind of the thread that runs through your career. And it's taken you from art to creating parks and then to real estate development, is just trying to make a more beautiful place.
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. And when I think of, and that beauty, you know, if you really stop and think about even the way that we feed ourselves, you know, so much of that, I mean, if you look at, you know, all the research and the stats that are out there around, you know, the more money you make, the healthier you are in general. And people can afford to feel like, okay, I deserve to treat myself this way. And the poorer you are, the less likely you are to have that attitude. And so for us, it's not just, it's like, not that everybody needs to be rich and in any way, although it'd be better if everybody had at least a minimum viable way to support themselves. It's more about, do you feel as though, is your self-esteem high enough to believe that you know you deserve to take care of your own body? And that's, I think, a big challenge that, you know, those of us who are really looking at how we can, you know, prepare low status communities and support low status communities in their own quest to be their best selves. That's a hard kind of thing to push because frankly, you know, it is easier, you know, to go to a McDonald's, you know, and you know, for the calories and, you know, it's filling, you know, it tastes good, blah, blah, blah. But what is it doing to your body? And those are the type of, and if you're not thinking about that, then, you know, as you put on the pounds, as, you know, you develop diabetes, it's kind of like, well, what else did you expect? Versus, oh, no, I'm utterly alarmed. Like, I'm going to change everything.
So I know probably our listeners are also just inspired as I am listening to you. What are some small ways that we can empower that change in our communities, that change towards a positive attitude towards our own health?
I mean, small steps, you know, from, you know, just deciding that you're going to, you know, try a new fruit or vegetable, you know, in your cooking, you know, looking at a website, you know, that, you know, shows you, like, looking at your website, which is so cool. Like, I'm dying to look at how do you make ice cream with olive oil. Like, that's just so interesting. You're like, what? You do that? So I have no idea. But stuff like that is just sort of like, oh, this is interesting. You know, I personally subscribe to like a bunch of health and wellness sites. They tell me all sorts of things. Am I going to do all of it? No. But am I going to do some of it? Absolutely. Just because someone else is out there doing it. And I think as far as, you know, within, you know, local communities and for some of your viewers, you know, if you visit community businesses in places you don't normally shop, you know, and support them with your dollars. You let them know, like, yo, this is hard to be an innovator out there doing stuff like this and to be the first on the block. Like the young woman that we're going to be incubating for her boutique studio, exercise studio, she's doing spinning and yoga and Pilates. There's been nothing like that here. You know, we're definitely like putting the word out, like people need to support, you know, folks like this who are doing this because she is taking a risk. You know, we've taken a risk with the Boogie Down Grind Cafe. We're taking a risk with everything that we're doing, but we know that if once we do it, others will follow. And we're making it easier for the next person to be out there so that they can build these businesses to support a more healthy lifestyle within communities like this. So whether it's supporting a crowdfunding campaign, you know, like go shopping at a place like that, or, you know, visiting a studio, all that kind of stuff, it just helps in both the short and the long term.
So support your local innovators and change makers, maybe research your city and see what are some of these projects, exciting projects that you can get behind.
Exactly. That's the most important thing because they're businesses. But again, we have to deal with the fact that we do have these demand deserts and what we can do. We're responding to them, but we can also support them.
And how can we support you?
Oh, gosh. Okay. Well, on literally our coffee shop, we're doing like a special holiday, wonderful promotion where for $25, we're offering this. We work with a local roaster. So we're doing some coffee beans, some unground coffee beans, and a mug and a French press for $25. So, and we do ship. So if you want to do that, our Instagram is Boogie Down Grind. So that would be awesome.
Cool. So I can order that here in Indianapolis.
Absolutely. Okay. And, you know, show your Boogie Down Grind love. That would be awesome. We're super excited about it. And it's really just very sweet. Wonderful.
Fantastic. Well, Majora, it's been an incredible pleasure to speak with you today. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Majora slipped in one little tidbit of wisdom at the end there. She said, maybe one way to have a healthier lifestyle is to try new things.
Absolutely. Part of learning about food is taking those risks to try new things. And some of you might be surprised to learn that I used to be a picky eater. I was very, very particular about what I ate. And the more I started to learn about food when Alex and I got married and learned how to cook, the more I expanded my horizons. And just taking one little risk every day helped me to embrace a new way of eating.
So we have a recipe today that maybe will allow you to try something again that you didn't like in the past and try something new that you haven't tried yet.
Right. We've talked on the show, I think, about Brussels sprouts and how they used to have the worst rap. I grew up being told by my dad how disgusting they were because he grew up eating them canned and they were soggy and they were bitter. And I tried them once I started learning how to cook. I tried them roasted and I fell head over heels in love with these things. And so since then, I've been trying to convince my dad that Brussels sprouts are amazing. Now, since then, Brussels sprouts have gotten a little more trendy. I've noticed that when I post a photo of Brussels sprouts online, people go crazy about them. So that is a good thing. That shows that we are learning to re-embrace this food. So the old ingredient you may have already tried is Brussels sprouts, and now we're going to dress them up a little bit with some harissa and goat cheese.
So what is harissa?
Harissa is a chili pepper paste from North Africa. So it's mainly in Tunisia, Algeria, Morocco type of region. And it's become a lot more popular now. We've seen it in lots of groceries here in town. You can also order it online. And there's a spicy version and a mild version. So if you do the mild version, it's just adding some really delicious flavors, some spices and some pepper flavor. If you go with the spicy, it's also bringing the heat. So don't worry if you're not into spicy, you can still get a mild harissa with this one.
So for the recipe, you basically roast the Brussels sprouts. And once it's done, you toss in some goat cheese and let it kind of melt and get all gooey. Top it with this harissa sauce and you have a fabulous dish with pretty simple effort.
Exactly. I could eat this nonstop. I think every meal pretty much.
Wow.
Or a snack, or it's perfect as an appetizer. I mean, you can do anything with this. And a bonus for the holidays, it's red and green and white. So it works.
We don't necessarily recommend eating it for every meal.
Right. Maybe every other.
So that is our episode. We will provide links to the recipe in the show notes, as well as links to that coffee gift set that Majora talked about and our cookbook. So you can find all of that in the show notes.
Happy holidays from all of us here at A Couple Cooks.